Good morning. Welcome to Lecture 10 of our series on the regulation of financial institutions. Today's lecture marks the end of the second third of this lecture series, so we are beginning to enter the final few weeks of the course. And for a slight change of pace in this week's lecture, I thought I would do something a little bit different than what we've done in the prior classes. In particular, I'd like to spend the better part of today's session going over a talk that I gave just last week in London to a number of attorneys about the regulation of financial services in the 21st century. This will give you a little better idea of the kind of academic research I'm personally interested in, as well as a sense of some of the topics that financial attorneys and policymakers in Europe and the United States are considering at the present time. However, before we turn to the talk, which will form the bulk of the section's lecture, I wanted to say a few concluding comments about the disposition of insolvent banks and really just point those of you who have particular interest in this area to the sections of the casebook that deal with this topic in greater detail. There are a number of additional legal issues that are important to understand in discussing the disposition of insolvent banks. And in particular, there are some concerning attorneys, at least in the United States, which you may find of some interest. So for this initial part of the lecture, let me just indicate to you the materials that are included in the sections of the casebook dealing with failed and insolvent banks once they have been closed. And essentially, there are four sections of the casebook that are relevant here, sections D through H, and let me just walk through them rather quickly. Again, those of you who are interested can look at the sections in greater detail at your own time. If you have particular questions about these readings, feel free to post them for me in the discussion area of the website, and I'll be happy to respond to them as best I can. One issue that I'd like to just mention is the relationship between bankruptcy law in the United States and bank receivership law. The case that illustrates this best in the casebook is a piece of litigation called the Board of Governors versus M-Corp. And actually, we've already discussed, to some extent, the legal issues underlying this case. It's the so-called source of strength doctrine. And what happened in the United States was the M Bank failed, and its primary supervisory authority, which is the Federal Reserve Board, sought to bring an enforcement action against M Corp Financial, which is the holding company, and essentially seize assets from the holding company and use those assets to, if not restore the subsidiary bank to solvency, at least reduce the cost of the failure to the federal government. Now, this case is about the bankruptcy bank insolvency interface because M Corp itself, the holding company, M Corp Financial, sought protection under the federal bankruptcy code. And in fact, as a corporation, it was subject to bankruptcy rules under the federal bankruptcy code, which were different than the rules governing MBank. So in the United States, we don't have a consolidated bankruptcy proceeding that includes financial institutions. We tend to have specialized rules for financial institutions and then another set of rules for corporations. And what the piece of litigation was about that's in the casebook is whether a bank regulator could intervene in the regular bankruptcy proceedings and claim assets of M Corp Financial. The answer the case gave was, in this particular context, at this particular time, it couldn't reach in and grab the assets. It could make a claim of various sorts, but that would have to be handled in the ordinary bankruptcy proceeding. The point that I think you should just be aware of here is that one needs to consider the relationship between financial institution solvency rules and other corporate insolvency rules if you have two separate systems such as we have in the United States. There are also Even within the bank insolvency rules in the United States, a whole set of specialized rules dealing with the ordinary matters of insolvency, such as who are valid creditors, what are the priorities of creditors, are there special voiding powers which the receiver can use to diminish the liabilities of the insolvent institution. And when I say that we have a specialized set of insolvency rules for depository institutions and other financial institutions in the United States, what that means is we have special rules governing priorities and creditors and the various issues that arise in the context of insolvencies. If you read through the casebook's material on these matters in subsection F primarily, although subsection G deals with comparable issues, you'll see some of the more important statutory provisions discussed. And let me just highlight a few of them for you to give you a flavor of the kind of rules I'm discussing. Those of you who are interested can read separately, I hope. For example, there are a number of rules dealing with the rights of claimants against failed institutions. In the problem that we looked at in last week's lecture about the disposition of a failed institution with a variety of possible acquirers, we really concerned ourselves with only one class of creditor, which is the depositor, both insured and uninsured. There are, of course, other potential claimants with respect to a failed intermediary. The general rule in the United States is that the depositors have a preference, and other claimants, creditors, are not generally allowed to have security, so they can't have secured claims that would effectively give them priority over depositors. And there are also a special set of rules which allow depository institution receivers to limit their obligations with respect to other claimants, various ways in which they can reduce their liabilities through things such as repudiation of claims. And those of you who are interested, I suggest you take a look at Section 1821E, which gives the FDIC as receiver certain rights to repudiate contracts or other claims of creditors under certain circumstances. These creditors do have the right to damages for such repudiation. However, the amount of the damages are less typically than would be available against an ordinary corporate bankrupt entity. There's cases discussing this and some questions discussing it as well in the casebook, but I think this, the rule to remember is that the receiver's powers in the banking context are stronger than the receiver powers in other areas. We can see similar illustrations of this kind of problem in the case of Murphy v. FDIC, which had to do with an entity that was the debtor of a failed bank, and there was a contractual relationship arising out of a lending transaction, and there was a potential legal dispute between the owner of the borrower, Bruce Murphy, and the bank. Litigation ensued, and the question that this case addressed was the rights of a debtor, someone who owes money to the bank, to seek a recovery against the bank once it failed, essentially affecting the rights of the bank to repayment of the loan as initially promised. And what this case explains is that there are also special powers of receivers to improve their rights to collect on assets. I think that's probably the best way to explain it. These rights have been developed over the years by the courts. There's something called the Deutsche Dummy Doctrine, which is discussed in the casebook on page 301. And then there's also its statutory codification at 1823E, which is also discussed in the Murphy case. As before, the receiver has special rights with respect to assets, to recover on those assets. And I think it's fair to say that in the wake of the thrift crisis and the banking problems in the United States in the 1980s, the FDIC as receiver was quite aggressive in seeking to use these special powers to gain additional assets, avoid additional liabilities for failed banks. In many respects, the FDIC as receiver was successful in these efforts, but by the 1990s, mid-1990s, the courts began to cut back on their capacities to some extent, out of a sense, I think, that they were maybe overusing these powers. Murphy is a case which is in this spirit, and so if you want to get a sense of the kind of issues that arose in this context, I'd suggest you take a look at the Murphy case. There are also a specialized set of rules for failed banks in the area of what might be considered fiduciary duties, the obligations of various parties to failed banks. And typically, the way these particular legal issues arise is after a bank has failed, there will be litigation against certain parties to recover at least a portion of the losses that the entity suffered and to gain additional assets, really for the FDIC as receiver. So while formally these actions look like actions by the corporation, by the bank, against directors and officers, they're really actions by the federal government to diminish the cost of bank failures for the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and therefore the federal government. So I think it's probably best to understand these actions as comparable to the source of strength doctrine that we discussed earlier in the course. In the source of strength doctrine, the government is bringing claims against a holding company to provide capital to make cash infusions into a failing bank. There are alternative parties. Officers and directors could be asked to pay in funds if they breach certain duties, as well as other parties, and as we'll see in a second, the other parties in the United States, at least, sometimes can include attorneys. In the case book, I think the best case exploring this issue is the Atherton, the FDIC case, which went all the way up to the Supreme Court a few years ago. That was a case involving a savings institution, depository institution, that failed. The FDIC was appointed receiver eventually, and what they did as receiver was bring actions against various officers and directors for negligence in operating the institution. Now, the case is really quite a complicated case about federal and state law in the United States, and if you're interested in federalism, I would encourage you to read the case. But what you should just know is that there is a general law in the United States that creates legal obligations on the part of officers and directors to their banks. That law can be found in 1821K in your statutory supplement, and essentially it establishes a standard of gross negligence. If a officer or directory is grossly negligent in their conduct of affairs, they can be held liable to the FDIC. The Atherton case explored a related question, which is, could they be held responsible for being simply negligent, which is a lower standard of care, under state law? And the Supreme Court concluded in the case that, yes, they could. But I think what's interesting is just that we do have law in this area that makes officers and directors responsible. They can be held liable. And over the past 10 years, the federal government has been aggressive in pursuing these claims after the fact, in part to recover funds, but also in part to make officers and directors more accountable for their conduct of affairs and presumably more cautious in their management of depository institutions to prevent failures of the sort that preceded the Atherton case. Now, I mentioned earlier that sometimes attorneys are also the subject of comparable enforcement proceedings. And the casebook in the final section, subsection H of the chapter, talks about a number of cases of this sort where attorneys were prosecuted for monetary sanctions of various sorts. Perhaps the most well-known example in the United States, which is discussed on page 418 of the casebook, is the Kay Schuller enforcement proceedings. The Kay Schuller case involved a very notorious thrift institution, savings institution, called Lincoln Savings and Loan Association. I mentioned last week that when depository institutions fail, usually the losses are 10 to 20% at most of the assets. Lincoln Savings was a case where the losses were over 90% of the assets. It was an institution that, in retrospect, was rife with fraud and non-performing loans. And after its failure, there were a lot of actions against officers and directors for a variety of things, including simple negligence in the conduct of affairs. But there was also actions against the attorneys, the Kay Schuller law firm. Now, interestingly, the way the action in the Kay Schuller case was brought was as an enforcement action by the Office of Thrift Supervision, which was the regulator of Lincoln Savings. And they essentially brought a cease and desist order against the law firm that had been representing Lincoln Savings in various regulatory matters. And their allegations are quite interesting. Essentially, they argued that Kay Schuller misled them about the state of affairs at Lincoln Savings, withheld documentation, and generally hampered their supervision of the institution. So Kay Schuller, which is quite a prominent and a well-regarded law firm, and was essentially in litigation with the OTS over various examination matters, was subsequently sanctioned by the federal government for their behavior. Now, again, I'll leave it to you, if you're interested, to look at the details of what Kay Schuller did. I think you should know that this enforcement action was highly controversial in the United States, and there are many who say that Kay Schuller did nothing wrong, but they ultimately did agree to pay a substantial monetary penalty in order to settle the proceeding with the federal government. And what should interest you, I think, structurally is the way the proceeding was organized. OTS, the Office of Thrift Supervision, brought a cease and desist order, actually a temporary cease and desist order, which is a related enforcement procedure, against Kay Schuller as a, quote, institution-affiliated party. And legally, this is the interesting category. The federal regulators have authority to go after institution-affiliated parties. Those include controlling shareholders and parties that have a controlling relationship with depository institutions, but they also include a broader category of entities. And if you look in the statute, I would invite you to take a look at 12 U.S.C. 1813U for the definition of institution-affiliated party. You'll see that under subsection 4, it includes independent contractors, that is, those in a contractual relationship with depository institutions, including specifically attorneys, accountants, and appraisers, who behave in a certain way. Now, they have to knowingly and recklessly participate in some sort of prescribed activity, violation of law, fiduciary duty, unsafe and unsound practice, that causes more than a minimal financial loss, or is likely to do so. So lawyers and accountants who are knowingly involved in these high-risk activities are potentially subject to enforcement actions by the federal government, and the federal government has prosecuted them in a number of cases, not a large number, but a number of cases, the most prominent of which is the Kay Schuller case. Now, it's an interesting question. As I mentioned, this is highly controversial in the United States. You can imagine that it's the lawyers who are most concerned about this, but I think it is safe to say that it has greatly affected the behavior of lawyers who represent depository institutions in this country. They are extremely concerned that they not be susceptible to prosecutions of this sort, and they are much more careful now in the representations they make to the federal government with respect to depository institutions, because they know if things go wrong, there is a potential of this kind of liability hanging over their head. So it's had a behavioral effect. Whether it's just ended up making lawyers excessively cautious and excessively concerned about their own liability, that's a debatable point. I've actually written articles on the subject, and there's a little excerpt of one of them here. It's a complicated question of regulatory design, but this is an option of regulatory control that we have pursued, at least to a certain degree in the United States, and it's one that other countries may or may not want to consider in the design of their own regulatory structures. So that concludes what I want to say about other issues in the disposition of insolvent institutions. Those of you who are interested, please post questions or comments on the discussion group. What I'd like to do now is to turn to the second topic for this morning's lecture, which is the regulation of financial services in the 21st century. This topic and the slides upon which it's based were really a talk which I gave at the Harvard Club of London earlier this month about regulation in the 21st century. And I thought it would be of interest to members of this class because it explores a number of issues in the international context, really, that are related to the basic issues we're discussing in the course. I gave the talk the subtitle, Centralization, Competition, and Privatization, because those really were the issues I wanted to explore in the lecture. These are, as I will explain over the next few minutes, different ways of approaching regulatory design, which from time to time we have applied internally in the United States within our federal system. But more recently, they've become important topics or concepts for regulation in the international financial community. So I'm going to be talking about these approaches to regulatory design for the remainder of today's lecture and trying to explain to you how they arise and how academics in the United States and in Europe are thinking about them today. Now, substantively, what I want to do is talk about three different areas of law, which some of you may be familiar with. Others of you may not be aware of them. But for most legal academics in the United States, or in fact for most lawyers in the United States, the most common area where these kinds of issues are discussed are in what we call the market for corporate charters. Corporate charters are the law governing corporations in the United States. And what I'd like to do is begin to describe to you the debate in this area, and then I will move into the financial topics that are more directly related to our course of study this semester. Sure. In the United States, corporations can be organized in any of the 50 states. And so you could organize a corporation in California, and that corporation could then do business anywhere in the country. What's peculiar about this structure is the organizational law of the home state of California governs the business of the corporation wherever it goes, and in particular, the duties of the officers and directors to the corporation, the rights of shareholders in the corporation, are governed by the home state's law, no matter where the corporation does business. Now, this has been true in the United States for many years, and it has resulted in corporations essentially having a choice about where to organize. And as this slide sort of indicates by the strength of the lines, the state that is the most common state for American corporations to organize in is the state of Delaware, a relatively small state in the eastern part of the United States that has gained essentially a reputation for being the most popular location for companies to organize. So the vast majority of major corporations in the United States organize themselves under the law of Delaware and then do business around the country and indeed around the world. As I mentioned, this has been true in the United States for a number of years. For most of this century, Delaware has been the leading state for corporate charters. But in the last 25 years, there has been a considerable amount of academic attention about whether or not this phenomenon of Delaware being the dominant state of incorporation is a good thing. And the slide that is appearing now on this screen shows, in a sense, the progression of academic commentary about this phenomenon. In 1974, the first important article was written about the role of Delaware, and this was written by a William Carey, a professor at Columbia Law School, and he wrote an article called Federalism and Corporate Law, in which he first raised the question about whether or not it might be bad for Delaware to become such an important state because they might be developing state corporate law that was not actually in the best interest of investors or shareholders, that somehow there would be what's known as a race to the bottom in the corporate law field if people could choose their regulatory regimes. This engendered a substantial debate over the last 25 years in the United States about the regulation of corporate charters. Those in the Carey tradition basically were concerned about the race to the bottom that could take place. Joel Seligman, a prominent writer in the past 10 or 15 years, was of this view. The opposing side was in favor of regulatory competition between states and corporate charters, and essentially believed that we wouldn't have to worry about a race to the bottom because investors would choose to invest in corporations that had the best corporate law, and for that reason managers would pick the state with the best corporate law, and rather than having a race to the bottom, there would be a race to the top, that the best regulatory structure would prevail. Occasionally this is referred to as the genius of American corporate law. That's a term that Roberta Romano of Yale Law School has championed in her publications. And it is a view of corporate law that believes that competition between regulatory structures is a good thing and that it will generate better results. Now, there are some writers in the United States, I think actually some of the most interesting writers are Lucian Bebchuk and several others. Lucian Bebchuk is a professor at Harvard Law School who believes that you can't really tell whether there's going to be a race to the bottom or a race to the top without further detailed empirical study, so it's sort of an intermediate position. But within the corporate law field, there has been this classic debate in the United States whether we should centralize our corporate law by having a single federal corporate charter or whether we should allow the states to continue to compete. So these are in the United States two well-known positions regarding the corporate law structure. And what I would like to just mention at this point is that these two views, the race to the bottom versus the genius of corporate law, are views about which public authority should establish corporate law provisions. That the difference of opinion between the two classic views is it should be the central government or the state federal system of law. A third perspective, which is really quite a different perspective, is an argument that the government should really not itself be engaged in the business of establishing any sorts of corporate law, that should be something that private parties do just as they establish most of the rules of ordinary contract. I would characterize this approach as a private regulatory structure where the private parties, individual parties, are left to decide what corporate governance structures they want. And there's been a series of writing about this view. I would characterize it as a regulation through privatization. corporate law still exists in this view of the world, but it is just a default regime. It's just a rough cut at what the rules should be, and private parties are then free to change the terms of the corporate contract if they want. In essence, this is an extension of the regulatory competition view of the world, where the proponents of regulatory competition believe that there should be different states choosing different regulatory structures for parties to select from. The privatization view extends this in the sense that the parties no longer need to depend on a state to propose a rule. They can, in essence, make their own regulatory structure. So in the United States, there has been this debate between centralization, competition, and essentially privatization of corporate governance structures. And what I wanted to do in my talk, and what I will just introduce you to today in this summary, is that this debate has now moved from the American domestic corporate law context into the field of international financial regulation. And let me describe to you how that has taken place in two areas. One is what I refer to here as securities regulation, and then the other is in the area of the supervision of financial conglomerates. Securities regulation, just so you know, is the regulation of corporate issuers and the regulation of the kinds of disclosure that corporate issuers have to make before they can sell their securities into the public markets, and also the kind of disclosure that they have to continue to make as long as their securities are traded in public markets. In the United States, there has never been regulatory competition in the securities field, as there was in the corporate law field, for a reason of historical accident, perhaps. But what happened in the United States is when the securities laws were first developed in a serious way, which is in the 1930s, they were developed at the federal level, and there was a uniform federal system created, not a state-by-state system. And so there was no opportunity to compete between states in the securities law market. The federal government essentially established federal securities law. It was a centralized system of regulatory structure. To the extent that there was an academic debate in the securities field, it was between those who thought the New Deal 1930s centralized structure was a good idea and some fairly marginal economic analysts who thought that the private markets could adequately regulate securities disclosure. And this view represented by what we refer to as the Chicago School in the United States, which are the most liberal free market economists, took the perspective that the New Deal legislation was probably a bad idea, that the private sources of regulation, privatization of securities regulation, would have been better. And there was a relatively short debate that took place in the 1970s about whether or not the securities markets were properly regulated by the federal government. But the consensus view that developed really a fairly long time ago, but was formally described probably best in 1984 in a series of articles, including one by John Coffey, was that mandatory disclosure rules by the federal centralized government was a good thing. That was essentially, I think it's fair to say, the state of play for a number of years coming into the 1980s. But in the 1980s, the securities markets essentially began to change their regulatory structure. Rather than being national markets regulated by national governments, for example, in the United States, increasingly issuers were accessing multiple markets, and the most traditional dual listing would be between London in England and the United States. And when a corporation found itself engaged in raising capital in both of these markets, it also found itself subject to overlapping regulatory structures. And that created lots of difficulties for practitioners in the securities field, and eventually posed challenges for regulatory authorities as well. The main difficulty, I think it's fair to say, is that there was overlapping and sometimes even contradictory regulatory rules being imposed in the field of securities regulation when issuers found themselves subject to two securities regulation regimes. The field of takeovers is where the conflicts were most acute, but in the general area of corporate disclosure, there were often instances of what seemed to be redundant and duplicative requirements. Now, it probably makes sense to spend at least a moment explaining exactly what the problem of overlapping regulation is. One set of problems, which is probably obvious, is that there are cost considerations when you have duplicative regulatory structures serving essentially the same goal. So if a corporate issuer has to comply with both English and American securities regulation standards, it's going to incur additional costs, potentially unnecessary costs. In addition to that, though, there will be some discouragement of certain issuers from raising capital in the international markets in the first place. Issuers that might have wanted to go into both markets will then choose not to. So there will be some loss of presumably valuable and viable economic activity. Perhaps even more disturbing to regulatory authorities, though, is the kind of avoidance problems the duplicative regulation creates. What we know from observing various regulatory structures in the past is that when regulatory costs become too high, individuals and enterprises will make efforts to avoid those costs by changing the way they behave. And what we tended to see in the United States, at least, that more and more issuers were deciding to move offshore to avoid duplicative regulation, and as a result, we were losing all regulatory control over these enterprises. And on top of that, domestic investors, whom our regulatory system is designed to protect, were finding themselves unable to make certain kinds of investments. Their opportunity to diversify their portfolios were being diminished, particularly smaller investors that couldn't afford to themselves move offshore in pursuit of these investment opportunities. So there was a widespread perception that there was a problem of inconsistent overlapping international regulations. And what I'd like to discuss now are the various efforts that are ongoing to deal with that problem. My claim is that these efforts can be organized into centralization, competition, and privatization. And let me just begin with the centralization trend. Here, centralization means the creation of a centralized system of regulatory authority, not on the national level, as we were talking about before with corporate charters, but on an international level, the creation of international standards for securities regulation. Now, the problem in developing any kind of international standard is that the mechanisms of a national government and a national enforcement authority doesn't necessarily exist in the international field, and in particular in the field of securities regulation, there aren't well-developed international authorities in place. There's something called the International Organization of Securities Commissioners that has made some efforts to harmonize securities regulation, and there's also a group of international financial accountants that has worked in the accounting field at similar efforts, but it's been quite difficult to generate binding international standards on a global level. And so what's tended to happen on the centralization front in this area is that half measures of various sorts have been attempted, either at the bilateral level, where different countries' regulatory authorities enter into memoranda of understanding with other regulatory authorities, or in subgroups of countries such as the European Union, where there is a collection of countries joined together in a bureaucratic mechanism, the European Union and the European Commission, which has been the basis for the development of harmonized security systems within the context of Europe. So there have been some efforts to centralize, but what's interesting, I think, is that there have also been some efforts to facilitate regulatory competition. One of the things that we've seen is that regulatory competition has begun to be allowed in the area of securities regulation in the international context. Now, let me describe a little bit what that means. What I mean by regulatory competition is a structure of law that's more like the corporate governance rules in the United States than overlapping systems of securities regulation, so that an issuer that's primarily located in the United Kingdom is being allowed to sell its securities in the United States, at least in certain markets, without fully complying with the regulatory structures of the United States. In essence, in certain areas, we are ceding our jurisdiction to the regulatory structures of other countries and letting their regulatory rules apply. Now, I'm sure some of you have been studying international securities regulation. If you did, or those of you who are going overseas to study it, when you do, you can see things like the multi-jurisdictional disclosure rules, Regulation S, Rule 144A. These are fairly technical rules of the U.S. regulatory structure, which facilitates regulatory competition. I think as a theoretical matter, you might be more interested in the academic people who have been writing on this subject, Professor Romano from Yale, who I mentioned earlier, and then Professors Choi and Guzman, who were at Berkeley, have written a series of articles over the last 2 years arguing that in the securities markets, regulatory competition between jurisdictions would be a desirable development, and they have been recommending that it be facilitated in a variety of ways and extended. Interestingly, there's also a group of writers in the United States, at least, who are arguing that securities regulation should be privatized in this area. It shouldn't depend on national government setting rules that compete, but anyone who is a plausible regulatory authority should be allowed to do so. And in particular, what the writers here, in particular Paul Mahoney of the Virginia Law School, has suggested is that the exchanges, which are private organizations in various countries that facilitate trading markets, should be allowed to create their own disclosure systems and have them recognized around the world. So this is a more extreme view again, but in general, the notion that there may be, should be competition in the securities field between jurisdictions is one that's getting considerable attention in academic circles and some degree of implementation in policy circles, especially in the area of institutional investors, where the investors are large and capable of choosing carefully and presumably intelligently which securities to purchase. In the field of the supervision of financial conglomerates, there has been a similar rethinking of the appropriate structure of financial institutions regulation in the international context over the past few years. Here, I think the dominant concern has come from the series of crises in the international financial markets over the last 3 years, from problems initially located in single jurisdictions, which seem somehow to have spread not only through the region of the globe in which these economies are located, but really throughout the international economic system. Our current system, or our traditional system of financial institutions regulation, has been built on a territorial model where the regulatory structure was primarily focused on transactions internal to particular markets. And so the U.S. banking, insurance, securities firm regulatory structure was focused primarily on securities firms in the United States. If those firms went overseas, we did not particularly supervise them, particularly if they expanded overseas in the form of affiliated parties. And for the most part, we expected that the domestic U.S. operations of foreign financial firms would be primarily supervised by the United States and not their home country regulators. So the regulation of financial intermediaries was largely conducted on a territorial basis. But these problems of the last few years called that regulatory structure into question because there appear to be greater possibilities for regulatory contagion across national boundaries. And there was mounting concern really over the last two decades, but more pronounced even in the last few years, about this territorial structure of financial operations. One attempt to deal with this problem is through centralization. And I think we've probably looked at the most important illustration of centralization in the financial institution field when we looked at the Basel capital requirements of the 1970s. These requirements are quite interesting, actually, because they're one successful illustration of centralization in international finance. They were created at the instance of the United States Federal Reserve Board and the English Bank of England, and they were implemented through a mechanism, the Bank of International Settlement, that was well regarded in the field of bank supervision. So there was really an exceptional organization in place, and there was a strong initiative from leading members of the organization that made the creation of this standard possible. And it has served as an important, really, illustration of cooperation and coordination in international finance. Those of you who are interested in this area know that the Basel capital requirements are really under pressure right now. There are conceptually a few limitations in the original version, and there's a general consensus that reform is necessary, but it's proved to be much more difficult to revise and update these standards than to adopt them in the first place, making it somewhat questionable in the minds of some whether the Basel capital standards really will continue to be the model of international cooperation that they have been. But at least they are out there as an illustration of a coordinated regulatory strategy on an international level. And there are some illustrations of how other regulatory groups have tried to emulate the Basel standards, for example, in the securities field, although I think it's fair to say that those coordinating efforts in other areas have not been quite so successful. Centralization, however, is not the only illustration of innovative reform in the international area. There are a number of other standards that are available, including one illustration, I think, of very effective privatization of regulatory structure in the case of the international swaps market, where there is a private organization, the International Swap Dealers Association, which has been instrumental in developing forms for the transaction of derivatives such as interest rate swaps, foreign exchange swaps, related kinds of swap transactions between financial intermediaries in many different markets. This is an area where one might have thought international public cooperation was going to be necessary, but in fact, so far, this private group has formed the backbone of the regulatory system in this field and has been instrumental in coordinating national regulatory structures. Again, there are questions now going forward whether the ISDA can continue to play the role that it's played in the past. The near failure of the long-term credit management corporation earlier this, well, 6 months ago, late 1998, has called into question some of the regulatory stringency in this field, but at least for the time being, there is an illustration of private regulatory cooperation in the international financial markets that has been at least reasonably successful. This talk is about three different forms of regulatory structure in the international markets, and so let me turn now to the third area of regulatory competition, which, as I've already described, is the characteristic structure of the American corporate governance market. It is a regulatory structure that is beginning to see experimentation, at least, in the securities regulation field. And I think if one looks carefully at what goes on in international financial institutions regulation, one can see elements of regulatory cooperation being permitted in this context as well. One illustration, after the failure of a bank known as BCCI in the early 1990s, there was a movement towards what's called consolidated supervision of financial conglomerates by their home country regulators, so that home countries are now taking a much more careful look at the worldwide operations of their financial conglomerates. They've been looking upstream to see what the owners of the financial conglomerates are up to in their activities, and also downstream to see what the subsidiaries are doing in overseas markets. This concern about overseas subsidiaries was highlighted by the Baring situation a couple of years ago, when a major European bank found itself in financial difficulties based on what was going on in the Singapore operations of the bank. And what you were beginning to see much more is for regulatory authorities to be looking not just with in their own territorial boundaries at what their banks and financial institutions are up to, but taking a global look at their operations. Of course, once regulatory authorities are supervising on a global basis, they are essentially in competition with other national regulatory authorities who are performing similar functions. So the beginnings of regulatory competition is going on in the general global markets. Within Europe, there's actually a specific case of something similar going on, which is a interesting development, and actually one that I'm studying a little bit this year. And let me just sort of graphically describe what goes on in Europe. If there is a bank located in London that wants to establish branches in other countries, other sovereign countries within the European community, the bank can now do so thanks to European reforms. And not only can it take its operations offshore, across international boundaries, but to a large degree, the regulation of the bank remains English, remains its home country regulator, even when it's doing business in other jurisdictions such as France or Spain or Germany or in any other country in the European Union. In essence, England is being allowed to export its regulatory structure into other countries, and there is a possibility now in Europe that we will see serious regulatory competition between bank supervisors that looks really very much like the kind of competition that goes on in the United States between corporate charters. There's a question, of course, whether it's a good idea or not a good idea. In Europe, one of the reasons that it's possible to have this regulatory structure is that some degree of centralization already takes place at the European community level in the form of a harmonized regulatory standard. So the European community sets a general standard of regulatory requirements. Each country within the union is supposed to meet it. But once each country meets it, the domestic firms within that each country can take their regulatory system and use it wherever they go. So the problem of overlap, duplicative regulation is eliminated, and the possibility for regulatory competition and the efficiencies that it promises in some context is created in the European market. So this is an interesting illustration of regulatory competition. And let me tell you about one other illustration, one that I've been personally involved in, and one that you may find of some interest, at least in terms of its suggestiveness for the direction of future regulatory reform. A few years ago, I was asked to work on a project for the United Nations Development Program involving Nepal, which is, as I'm sure most of you know, a underdeveloped country to a considerable degree, very low GNP per capita, and a country that's in need of economic stimulation. And a number of advisors have recommended that Nepal engage in financial services or engage in the development of a financial services center, try to become the Switzerland of the Himalayas in order to improve its economic situation. What I was basically asked to do was to make some recommendations for a group sponsored by the United Nations for financial regulation in a basically offshore financial district to be located in Nepal. So the idea was the Nepalese wanted to attract into their country foreign firms, foreign international financial services firms, to do business mostly with offshore customers, basically to make loans into India, other portions of Southeast Asia, various other locations, but to centralize their operations in Kathmandu in order to improve employment and to bring a new kind of industry into the Nepalese economy. So what was needed and what I was asked to do was create a regulatory recommendation for a regulatory system. Now, the standard approach to this problem, I think is fair to say, would have been to recommend the development of a regulatory system that was consistent with emerging international standards for supervisory oversight. Essentially, the Basel Committee has a set of core principles which describe the kinds of regulatory mechanisms that are necessary in the financial services industry. And one could easily have recommended to Nepal, what you need to do is adopt statutes on this model to encourage the creation of regulatory agencies to enforce those statutes. And then once those regulatory apparatus were in place, you can think about inviting in foreign international firms to conduct operations there. The problem with this approach, though, was for a country such as Nepal, the expense of creating an international financial regulatory structure would be considerable. Their expertise in the area was quite limited, their financial resources even more limited. And so what we were casting about for was a way of more efficiently and quickly creating a regulatory structure for Nepal. What we ended up recommending was a regulatory system where Nepal would license a limited number of banks or other financial firms to come into Nepal and essentially comply with their home country regulatory structure, whatever it might be. So if the Nepalese invited in a Swiss or a UK or a US bank or a Japanese bank, then those banks would each be governed by not Nepalese law, really, but the law of their home country. And the home country supervisors, before these firms would be allowed to enter, would have to agree to exert regulatory oversight of the Nepalese operations of their intermediaries. But if they did agree to observe that oversight, then there would be no additional requirements imposed under Nepalese law. This is, I think it's fair to say, a fairly pure example of regulatory competition. The Nepalese government would select the jurisdictions authorized to conduct oversight within Nepal, and it would, to some degree, participate in that oversight. But most of the regulatory apparatus would be essentially imported into Nepal from countries that it deemed qualified to engage in that oversight. This was, I think it's fair to say, a fairly radical approach to regulatory structure, but for a country such as Nepal that wanted to create a specialized system of regulation for a relatively small number of firms with very limited interactions with the Nepalese economy, it offered a very clean and simple way of creating a regulatory structure, and essentially it leaves the countries that are selected for incorporation free to compete with each other for the best regulatory structure. Whether or not this works out in practice as an idea remains to be seen. The Nepalese legislature has adopted legislation essentially authorizing experimentation with the idea, and various teams are working on implementing the concept. But it is, I think, a good illustration of regulatory competition of a sort that I think we're likely to see more and more of in the years ahead. If you look at our regulatory system around the globe, there is a lot of regulatory competition going on today in various areas, and it offers some interesting possibilities for the future of financial regulation in the 21st century. And it's one approach that may, in certain contexts, be appropriate. Centralization, no doubt, will also continue to be a major trend in the regulatory world. Whether it holds all the answers remains to be seen. Privatization, I think, of certain regulatory functions is also an important component of potential regulatory reforms. I see now that I have substantially gone over my allotted hour for the week's lecture, but I wanted to at least quickly run through the talk that I gave to give you some ideas about the sorts of issues that are being discussed in the United States right now. Exactly the application, the sort of application this would have to a country such as China, I'd have to say that I wasn't sure. China, of course, is a huge country with a major domestic market. Whether regulatory competition is relevant at all, I'm not sure. Of course, with the experiment currently going on in Hong Kong, one could say that there is an element of regulatory competition developing within China right now, with essentially two separate legal systems, and exactly how that competition will play out is something that I think is interesting to watch, and whether the experiment will be extended to other jurisdictions as time goes on is also an interesting question. But I thought I would just throw out these ideas for you to think about. If you have any comments or reactions, I'd be delighted to see your posting of them on the discussion group for this week. In any event, next week we will return to the primary subject matter of the course, which is going to be now the discussion of insurance regulation, which I'll begin on May 24th. So thank you again for your attention, and have a good week. I'll look forward to meeting with you again next week.